Yeah, I mean, sure, we have to do it.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order the May 12, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Thank you, everyone, for showing up this morning. We have a very interesting panel on regulatory reform. And this morning's informational hearing is the result of our regular committee hearings, where I think Steve Pfeiffer whetted the appetite of this committee in terms of its interest in reform and the need for reform, possibly, if we are to move forward with economic development in, or at least some kinds of economic development in some of our rural communities. With that, I'd like to call forward, please, as a panel, Steve Pfeiffer, Martha Pagel, Paul Herbenek, and
Frank Arisman.
Frank Arisman, please. Welcome to each of you. Good morning. Thank you for your willingness to present to our committee this morning. And we are very much looking forward to your presentations. Please decide among yourselves your order of testimony.
Thank you, Chair Witt, representatives. My name is Steve Pfeiffer, and as Chair Witt notes, I was here 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago. Mm-hmm. And we were discussing another piece of legislation or a panel of bills that largely dealt with mining in Eastern Oregon. And we're delighted to be able to come back and talk about regulatory reform. I will say at the outset, it's a bit of a caveat. We're going to keep it at a pretty high level, but I think what you'll find as I ask my colleagues to introduce themselves as well, that you've got before you a fairly practical, high level of experience of many years, if not decades, throughout the state on the permitting of mining, which is what we have all done and continue to do. So while we may start at a high level, we're hoping that it'll evolve into a discussion with you and a Q&A, for lack of a better way to put it, on some of the issues we face and perhaps what some of the legislative solutions, if that's the appropriate solution, could be. And with that, my background, then I'll ask my colleagues again to introduce themselves. I'm a land use lawyer, environmental lawyer, which my practice is primarily the pursuit of permitting for a wide range of development, not just mining, but a wide range of activities throughout the state at the state, federal, and local level. I also had the opportunity to serve on LCDC for 6 years. In the 90s into 2002, and I also chaired the subcommittee of that committee, which rewrote the mining rules at the local or state level for that, among the counties throughout the state, culminating in a rule in 96, which is still operating today with very limited amendment, which is an opportunity as well as others. And with that, I'll turn it to Martha.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Martha Pagel. I am an attorney and a shareholder with the Portland-based firm of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt. I've been there for about the past 15 years. I'm the chair of our practice group for energy, environment, and natural resources. My own practice focuses primarily on water-related issues, water supply, water compliance. That involves wetlands, DSL-type issues, as well as water rights with Water Resources Department and federal agencies, Endangered Species Act, and NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act compliance. My background before going into private practice, I think, is what puts me here today, and that is that I had nearly 20 years in state government here in Oregon. I was the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department for 8 years. I was the director of the Department of State Lands, at that time it was the Division of State Lands, for 3 years, and before that, I was an attorney in the Oregon Department of Justice. I was in the General Counsel Division advising natural resources agencies. So my entire 30-plus your career in law and policy in Oregon has been focused on natural resources and natural resources development. And as I mentioned, in the last 15 years in private practice, I primarily represent resource users of various types. Like Steve, I represent all different types of farmers, ranchers, industry, cities on municipal water supply, and a wide range of business and development interests.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Paul Ribernick, and I am a partner in the Portland firm of Black Helterline. I grew up in Eastern Oregon. My brothers were born in Enterprise. I was born in La Grande. My father was in the Forest Service, and so I'm quite aware of the resource issues and resource restrictions that we have in Eastern Oregon. After law school, I went to, of all places, the state of Louisiana, and I was the first, and I will also say the only, environmental lawyer in the entire state. This was in 1980, involved with a wide range of wetlands, permitting, and all those types of things. I missed home and came back to Oregon, and I came to work at Black Helterline. I've been there for 30-plus years. I am a member of our firm's land use and environment practice group. By way of background, I served for, I think, 9 or 10 years as Hillsborough's hearings officer in their land use matters, understanding the ins and outs and technical requirements of permitting all types of things in a municipality. But what I actually do for a living is I site gravel pits. Doesn't sound very romantic, but I've done more than 30 sites in 19 jurisdictions in the state of Oregon. I have been through the wars, and I used to have a full head of hair.
My name is Frank Erisman. I'm with the Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt firm in Portland. I practiced law, though, in Denver for over 40 years with a firm, the firm of Holm Roberts and Owen. And my specialty has been mineral law. In large part, it's mineral transaction law. If you think of what a real estate lawyer does, that's what I do. Except it's for minerals. The same, different vocabulary. I went to the Cairo School of Mines, got a degree in metallurgy, and then I went to law school, and I've worked my whole career with on behalf of mining companies, but also for native organizations. I represented for over 30 years the Doyon Native Regional Corporation out of Fairbanks on their mineral transactional work. So my experience is not so much on the permitting, it's more on the transactions, the buying, the selling, the financing of mineral projects, which of course involves the due diligence when you could do a transaction. So I would of course then be familiar with issues regarding permitting, and been involved in situations where a corporation is trying to decide which state do we go to. So hopefully some of that experience will help you today.
With that introduction, or set of introductions, let me begin. I'll spend a few minutes giving you a sense of a relatively high-level sense of the permitting process, primarily state and local. There is a parallel federal process involved on sites involving federal land. Again, federal land will involve federal permitting as well as state and local. And then secondly, on non-federal lands or private lands, which may trigger federal regulations, be it the Endangered Species Act or the Clean Water Act, will bring the feds to the table. I was just sitting here realizing, I spent yesterday afternoon, and I'll use this to give you a little bit of context before I tell you about the regulatory scheme. I spent yesterday afternoon in the field on a mine site. This is a mine site that has yet to see a shovel of dirt turned. It's near the metro area. We're running out of aggregate throughout the metro area at a fairly high level right now. The two quarries in the immediate vicinity are in the middle of reclamation, and so it's essentially a linear process, and a new mine will open as others close, for example. And I was there yesterday not with the county folks and not with the state folks, but rather with EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on a privately owned mine site in Clackamas County. Now, that's a little bit of context. It's not because the state and local regulatory schemes aren't alive and well and don't also apply to this property. They do. We're in our third year probably now, one trip to LUBA and the Court of Appeals. back again, approved finally by the county, and that was about a three-year ride. And now it is designated a significant aggregate resource on the county's inventories and their comprehensive plan. It is also now approved through the operating permit to mine at the county level. So in terms of just the state process, which again I'll describe next, we're through that state or the county process. What we have, though, on this 40-plus acre site is about 3 acres of wetland areas sprinkled throughout. Four pockets, basically. Those are regulated by the state and federal government. And because there are wetland issues, aquatic issues, EPA was happy to come along, and that's fine. I mean, they're not there because it's contaminated, as you usually think of EPA. They're there as an oversight regulatory agency to the core. So the point is, we're not through the woods, even though after those four plus years at the county approval process, we're still another probably year and a half, if not 2 years, at the federal level just to be able to get to the point of being able to turn a shovel of dirt. At the state level, historically, meaning before 1996, at the land use level for counties throughout the state, it was a bit of a catch-as-catch-can process for land use permitting, for aggregate quarries in particular. And we focus primarily on aggregate, as Paul notes, because we, as we discussed it the last time we met, there hasn't been, unlike in other states, a lot of mining, and Frank can speak to this a bit later, there's not been a lot of mining other than aggregate in this state. As Representative McEwen knows, the tar sands at Oregon Resources in Coos County is an example. Martha will talk about Calico, a mine in eastern Oregon, which is part of the way through the process for a gold project. I'm representing a large gold mining entity that when the time is right in the near term, they'll come out of the ground. But we don't have a large history of that. So when we talk about mining historically, meaning looking back, it's largely been aggregate, frankly. Sand and gravel. Not a lot of hard rock, but sand and gravel. Prior to 1996, depending on which of the 36 counties in the state you went to, you ran into a different set of regulations. Some regulated as a conditional use permit with these criteria. Some chose another process, different criteria. We had to tune up, as Paul notes, in every one of those 30. Prior to 96, when LCDC modified the rule to make it uniformly applicable to every county, we were doing it over and over again. And the problem we had with that, and I was one of the ones that pointed this out at the commission, that means we had 36 bodies of appellate case law. Because what was established by the appellate courts, and we do get appealed more often than not for various reasons, whatever the Jackson County Code said to regulate mining resulted in a body of appellate law unique to the Jackson County regulations. And then if you went to Josephine, you had another body of appellate law which you had to deal with because the regulations and the criteria were worded differently. At LCDC, we just realized that it was time to change that picture. So in 1994, we began a process to review and revise the mining laws, the aggregate mining process, and it applies to minerals, precious minerals as well, throughout the state in one fell swoop. LCDC has that authority through its administrative rule process. Goal 5, one of the 19 statewide planning goals, regulates, among other resources, wetlands, water bodies, and other things, aggregate, as well as oil and gas. We then proceeded at the LCDC level to adopt a new regulation, the Goal 5 rule pertaining to aggregate mining, which preempted all those county ordinances, essentially eliminated those county ordinances, and required all counties to apply this single uniform set of regulations, uniform set of criteria throughout the state, and that has resulted, for better or for worse, in a single body of case law now moving forward from 96 at least. We've got a lot of cases from the Court of Appeals in Luba on what that rule means, but at least they're equally applicable and equally binding. I actually believe that single act was an efficient step, and I think it did facilitate and improve the mining permitting process. There are still challenges in that regulatory scheme, and that could be modified by LCDC or by the legislature. But that's essentially the overview of the local process. That's in addition to, or actually Paul and I would tell you in advance, we typically pursue our county permits before we go on to the state water resources or Department of State Lands for the wetland permits, the water quantity permits, the Dungami operating permit. We usually don't get those until we know we have an approval out of the counties. So it's a serial process. You could pursue those simultaneously. It's just not proven to be a practical process for us. On the other hand, there are some efficiencies. Dagami is required by their administrative rules to issue an operating permit upon a final county, among other criteria that are met, a final county land use decision. So there are some things that work there that, that tend to collapse it. But the bulk of the action, certainly at the front end and going forward, and by the way, the state and federal agencies love the fact that the county are taking the first issues on early, because it means that a lot of the issues are framed by the time it gets to the federal level. I was able to tell EPA and the Corps yesterday when they asked about some impacts to surrounding water tables, for example. I was able to tell them, don't worry about it. I've got voluminous studies from that county permitting process that they will use as part of their federal analysis. It was an efficiency. Without going into too much detail, that county process is established by LCDC. Essentially requires that the comprehensive plan be amended to add, in most cases, if it isn't already on the inventory, and our experience has been often it's not, the new site to the county's acknowledged comprehensive plan inventories as a significant Goal 5 resource site. That's an inventory step. That's the first step. Then you submit a mine plan, a mining plan, a site plan, and all the various analysis and studies involving traffic, off-site impacts on agriculture, hydrology, other significant Goal 5 resources, and it goes into a county hearing process, ultimately culminating in an action by the County Board of Commissioners to approve or deny that package of permits. Now, as I think Paul will point out, one of the problems we see in the system, and I think if I had my druthers, one of the first amendments that I would see to the Goal 5 rule would be to make it more clear that you could coordinate all of those steps into one single decision by the county board. That process I just described takes anywhere from 6 months to prepare the application to 6 to 8 months to go through the process, plus another year on appeal. So round it up to 2 years, if you're lucky. What we find is often you have to get put on the inventory and be approved as a mining plan, but yet there's another level of what we call the equivalent of an operating or site plan permit, which is the really detailed review that starts that process all over again. If we could collapse those, that would be a much more efficient process. It's technically possible under the rule. My amendment wouldn't be needed to the rule, for instance, to allow it. It would be to mandate it at the applicant's election. In other words, if an applicant requested all the permits in one application from beginning to end, from cradle to grave, I would prefer personally that the rule, if at the applicant's election again, because there may be reasons why they don't do that, I would prefer that a county be required to do that in one fell swoop. The reason an applicant may not elect to do that is we don't know what those other state and federal agencies might do to the project in their review, which would force a modification. So we sometimes elect to keep that last final detailed site plan in abeyance until we know which wetlands get filled or are allowed to be altered or filled, which ones are required to be protected, other things that could evolve that conceptual approval, and then we will modify our final detailed approval to do that. But that could be our call. That's not always the case. So that's just to keep things moving. That's the state county process. When I say state, it's LCDC as a state agency establishing regulations by which every county shall review and approve or deny aggregate permits. And as Martha notes, and will probably note further, there are other state agencies that have a role in any aggregate mining project, from wetlands to water quantity to water quality, which is another big piece of this. And so there are two levels of state review, if you will, on that process. But that's a little bit of background for you on how the process works today.
Thank you very much. Before we go to our next panel member, one of the challenges that we have is allowing the panel to have continuity, but making sure that we are able to address any questions that our committee members have. And your panel is just large enough that I'm going to ask if the committee members have any questions after each presentation. We usually go through the various panel members, but maybe a considerable amount of time this morning before folks could get to their questions. So Committee members, anything for Steve at this point? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just the one thing, as far as streamlining this plan, you know, going to the counties, you said the permitting process now takes about 2 years, and maybe you covered this, but if you did that, what could you condense that down into time-wise? Or what would be maybe the objective goal?
I would think of it, Representative, in three ways, three levels. The application phase, which is on us, the applicant, but we have to be very thorough and detailed. And all of us involved, at least the three of us, are involved in a lot of different types of permitting activities, from office parks to industrial parks to hospitals to subdivisions. But the body of information that has to accompany an aggregate permitting application in most cases far exceeds what's required in many other permits, if in fact at the end of the day you're going to be defensible on appeal. And just as all projects are capable of being appealed, aggregate mining, for obvious reasons, the conflicts that it may pose, real or perceived, tends to lead to appeals even more than most other projects. So when you calculate that, we have to be extraordinarily
thorough,
diligent at the front end in preparing that application. So we're talking about the last application I submitted for what we call a PAPA, a post-acknowledgement plan amendment, was three binders totaling about a foot thick, and that was the submittal, which contained the narrative of how we met the criteria, plus all the various reports from all the specialists on how to do it. So that's basically, I would say, anywhere from, and Paul can jump in at some point, but I would tell you that from the day you start to the day you want to submit a credible application of that magnitude, you're going to occupy 4 or 5 months of time. The county review process rounded up to about 6 to 8 months. You're going to go through the Planning Commission. You're going to go through the Board of County Commissioners. The one I just mentioned that I was on site yesterday had three Planning Commission hearings and three Board Commission hearings and took about 7 months. And then that third phase is the appellate process, which here in Oregon, of course, goes straight to LUBA, the Land Use Board of Appeals, and then the Court of Appeals from there should it go beyond that. And LUBA round up to 6 months, and the Court of Appeals round up to four, because we have an expedited review of the LUBA process. Otherwise, the Court of Appeals would be 3 or 4 years, 2 or 3 years. So that's how I get to the 2 years. How do you make that more efficient? I'd like Paul and Martha to be thinking about that question as well. I don't know how much I could do about phase one. That's a matter of capital, resources, and focus on the part of the applicant. The county process is actually fairly efficient. We have in the rule a 150-day period whereby the counties are required to take action on our application from the day our application is deemed complete, which is about a month into it, to the day they take final action. And they tend to do pretty well to stay on that. As some of you may know, we have a similar rule, 120-day clock from completeness to action on all land use permits in this state, city, or county. Counties are a little different, but we've got a process there. There's not much you're going to be able to do about that LUBA process. You'll hear some people, anytime you talk about regulatory reform, most people don't talk about the amount of information, time, delay, et cetera, that requires an applicant to prepare their application, for good reason. I mean, that just is on an applicant. You're going to do it well. You're going to do it right. You're going to make it defensible. It takes the time. Most people don't talk about undue delays at counties or cities, in this case counties. You know, occasionally you'll get something stretching out, but it's pretty predictable in my experience. It's 6 to 7 months.
That's right. The county has, just so you're aware, the county has the ability, and they do this frequently, to come to you and say, we're not going to make our deadline. Will you, applicant, give us an extension?
An extension.
And you got no choice. Yeah. You tell them, yes, whatever you need, because, yes, you have a 150-day limit. We'll give you another 30 days. You try and parcel it out in 30-day limits, in 30-day increments, but that's a request that you can't refuse, because you're at that their complete discretion in terms of the final decision.
But I am going to touch on in that third phase, and Paul, I agree with Paul, we rarely get too abused by that. I mean,
they try.
Good effort at the local level. The appellate process. You're not going to shorten the appellate process on land use appeals in Oregon. It's going to be 6 months, and it's going to be 4 months at the Court of Appeals. Frankly, back in the day when we persuaded the legislature, collectively, a lot of people, the legislature imposed on the Court of Appeals a mandate to do expedited reviews of land use appeals. It was a phenomenal change. I think I shared with the committee last week, I have a DSL permit for a large project in Representative McCune's district, where the permit was issued by DSL in December of 2011. I had the oral argument at the Court of Appeals a month ago, and I won't get a decision for another year. Now that could use some help, and we've got more appellate judges, and we're working on that. But what I'll tell you, and I'll just touch on for lack of a better term, the sacred cow in many permit reform discussions, is the extent to which appeals should be more, well, the standing question. If you're going to, the only way you're really going to change that process is to minimize or reduce the potential for an appeal. In Oregon, and this isn't a judgment, this is simply a factual statement, appeals are very easy to file, standing bar is very low, and the cost is minimal, and there's virtually no exposure should you not prevail as an appellant of a project. I've had situations where I've won every assignment of error from LUBA through the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court, every single one. It still took 2+ years, and there was no exposure to the appellant from bringing that on other than the $300 filing fee at LUBA at the time and about $150 at the Court of Appeals. So the point is, if you were going to do that, and I'm not necessarily advocating that because, again, any permit reform discussion inevitably ends up, is our standing for appeals too liberal? Should we have a prevailing party fee so that people are more both sides? And I'll tell you, many of my developer clients don't support the prevailing party fee idea. That means whoever appeals, the loser pays the other side's attorney's fees. I've got developer clients when I suggest that. They balk for good reason. So the point is, and again, that's something we could talk about. It comes up every time. We've had various ideas. Other states have different ways of handling the standing question, but an appeal is assured in our case, and we just build it into the schedule. That's the only place there's really any room that I can see.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the LUBA appeal, though, I can live in Alabama and appeal your project in Oregon. Is that correct?
As long as you wrote a letter or showed up and testified at one of the hearings.
So if you had some sort of standing where I said this is a bad project or this is a good project and I submitted it to a hearing locally, then that means I would have standing.
You might have standing. Now, if you just submitted a letter, if you were sitting in your Barco lounger in Alabama and wrote a letter that said, I don't like that project, period. You may have standing to appeal. You would have standing to appeal because you testified orally or in writing. What you wouldn't arguably have is a credible basis for an appeal because you have to have raised the issues that you'll raise to LUBA at the local government level, or you're barred from raising them at LUBA, the idea being that the local government should be entitled to know what the claim will be, the claim of error. So the bad news is there'd be a six-month appeal. The good news is we probably prevail. I've actually been successful in striking entire briefs because all the issues they raised on appeal at LUBA were never raised before the local government, so LUBA struck the entire brief.
But what I'm leading up to is time is money.
Fair enough.
And what I've done is I've tied you up for 6 months, and I know I've never even been to Oregon. What kind of a system is that?
Well, it's the one that we have. I throw that out to you.
Why don't we change this system?
What you're getting at, I think, is that there is, in the Goal 5 rule that was adopted in 1996, there is a 1,500-foot impact area concept, and it's extremely mushy and extremely malleable, but there's certain considerations given to impacts out to 1,500 feet. It might be possible to look and say that in a permitting situation involving a land use, you need to have some skin in the game. You need to be near the project. You need to be within sight and sound, or within 1,500 feet, or some other thing, which prevents the Alabama Barco Lounger situation. That might be something that you could at least think about in terms of a way to limit the wide open appeal. Now, I would suggest to you that that's going to be something that's really hotly contested, because in Oregon we have this God-given right to appeal any dang thing we please.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is Alabama doesn't.
But
California doesn't.
If I were someone who was representing a person in Alabama and they called me up, I would say, here's what you want to do. Send in your letter. You want to have a very specific list of criteria that you want to object on, and you play it out, and then you've got standing under our situation. There's just no way around it. So there's lots of different ways that you can approach standing. One is a distance. I think you're going to run into problems constitutionally, probably, if you said someone from Alabama can't appeal.
Yeah, the residency issue.
I think that's going to cause problems, but that's a possible way to get at the issue, to kind of narrow the scope of actors that are involved.
Well, you could do that by saying you have to be contiguous.
You could be. You could do that. But
Well, Paul's right, though. The rule does say our analysis under the rule, and frankly, when I was chairing the committee, that was an intentional decision. And it really goes, Representative, to your point. We put in the rule there are criteria that have to be met, no adverse impact on surrounding properties generally. Within 1,500 feet of the proposed mining boundary. Now, the rule also has a provision that says if evidence is submitted that the impacts are reasonably likely to occur beyond that boundary, the county board can expand that boundary and require the applicant to assess something more than that. And like Paul, I've done 20 plus of these, and virtually every time there's a request, if not a demand, that it be extended to, the last one I had was extended 5 miles because there was a bridge that's one of the historic old covered Oregon covered bridges. But our traffic plan provided that the trucks will never cross that bridge. But the argument was that bridge is 5 miles away, so you got to expand the impact boundary 5 miles to the bridge. It didn't happen for a variety of reasons. The point being that 1,500 feet is already there. The next step that you're pointing to, Representative, is that that's within, if that's the area where the impacts are legislatively thought to be most likely to occur, that may also be the area where the adverse effects that could give rise to an appeal are most likely, and we draw the line for an appellant standing at 1,500 feet or if expanded. The other only other point I'd make is that Paul's right. This comes up every time, we talk about permit reform, and it blows the roof off for a variety of reasons, because this process, for better or for worse, of liberal low standing bar is integral to our Oregon land use system. I mean, it's just there. It's been there from day one. However, we would tell you that it would be a very, very large debate to make that change for all land use permits throughout the state for appeals. But we're talking about one type of permit, which is the subject of a very specific regulatory scheme in that rule. So you could impose a unique standing requirement, I suppose, by statute, just on projects subject to that Goal 5 rule.
Follow-up? Yeah. Yes. For the record, want to note that the immediately preceding commentary was by Stephen Pfeiffer, preceded by Paul Hebernick. Please.
Have to introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, just one other thing, Representative Escobar. This is Paul Hebernick again, for the record. There's also the issue of a straw man, and we've seen this before, where someone who has an interest outside the 1,500 feet area simply locates someone contiguous or within. And so, if there was going to be a solution that was crafted that way, I don't exactly know how you would get to that, but you would have to be able to say perhaps that in a situation someone really didn't have an interest, or it was later found they didn't have an interest, there could be attorney's fees or something. That's another consideration, because if you simply say you have to have contiguous property, it'd be my experience that they would be standing in line around any aggregate or mining operation to get folks next to that or landowners next to that to come in and say, yes, we'd love to be the person who appeals.
Follow up.
Please.
But see, this bleeds over to other issues as well. You know, you take subdivisions, you take houses out on EFU land. I mean, the list keeps on going and going. But I think the problem, in my opinion, is that we've created Senate Bill 100 for a certain intent, but we've gone off course with the LCDC and rulemaking, and not, in my opinion, we've encumbered the whole system to the point of where it's almost breaking down. And what I mean by that is that we had a situation in Medford, where I come from, where we had zoning for commercial, and it took them 8.5 years to get a permit. Well, that's ridiculous. It was zoned for that. And it's because of appeal after appeal after appeal after appeal to Luba.
You know, we're the choir on this.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'd like to be able to figure out how to fix that system, because that's wrong.
We do suffer serial appeals, and you're correct, and it is quite typical pattern that you will go to Luba, to the Court of Appeals, back down to the local government, back to Luba at least. That's almost guaranteed. You may go back to the Court of Appeals again. My personal record is twice to the Court of Appeals, three times to Luba, and the Supreme Court not taking jurisdiction. The appellants of one of them asked the Supreme Court to take jurisdiction. They refused. That was also in Medford. It was 14 years, and it was ultimately approved. And it's actually running now, and there are, I don't know, 15 jobs related to that particular quarry. But it took somebody with 14 years of experience. And maybe it's something of looking at your appeal rights and saying that all appeals have to be consolidated into one or something like that. We have that. Kind of, but it's very loosely interpreted by the courts.
I just wanted to add in, and we'll get to my piece of this a little bit later, but what you've been focused on, what you've been hearing about, is the land use process. Oh, sorry, Martha Pagel. You've been hearing
it's
about
on, Mr. Chair.
the land use process, which has all these multiple appeals and issues that come up. Overlay on top of that, multiple state and federal regulatory permits that also have to be approved for any given project, that also have, each one of them, their own separate process for contested case hearings and appeals to the Court of Appeals and opportunities to go to the Supreme Court, and they aren't on a synchronized time frame at all. So you have this pile upon pile of potential for delay, and it's not to say that all of these issues shouldn't be addressed in the process, but what we have is so many layers and so many different pathways for decision making, and no clear way to bring them all together, and no clear way to have a unified time frame for getting them all dealt with. But more to follow on that.
I'm Frank Erisman. I wanted to add something, because it goes to some of what I was going to say later. When you look at Oregon and try to feel, assuming they have the mineral base here compared to other states, what separates Oregon from other states? Oregon is unique in this land use process. It's been here long enough that it's second nature to everybody. They assume this is how it is everywhere. Wyoming, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, big mineral producing states, they don't have land use like this. They don't have law firms that have four or five condemnation lawyers. Unheard of to have, you know, you have to look hard in Colorado or Wyoming to find a condemnation lawyer. So the whole, there's an overlay just in the state that affects the ability of a mineral producer to move. And it's ingrained, it's second nature to you, but it really is an obstruction when you're trying to, why can't I do it like I do it in Nevada? Well, it's because, a lot of it's because of land use. On the other hand, the land use that you have on private lands here is very similar to the land use on federal lands. And so much of the mining in the West is on federal land. And so you are going to have this same kind of process there with standing. They do have rules with standing. Although they get around the rules. And I had a situation once where the Sierra Club sent somebody out to hike back and forth on this land because nobody really used the land. But then they felt like they could say, we have somebody with some standing that knows about and uses the land. So I think the person from Alabama could hire somebody to find a way to
stop,
be next to the land. Yeah.
Procrastinate or prolong one.
Representative Frederick.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that I want to cut through a little bit here, because I understand the concerns that you have, but I think you're really talking about a predictability aspect, that you're looking at some way of actually finding a predictable approach, and that you're dealing with state, federal, county, et cetera, and because of the various scheduling that you struggle with finding some kind of predictability. That's what I'm getting from this. I mean, we can go over the whole fight over Senate Bill 100 again and again and again. Frankly, I think that's not productive. We're not Nevada, thank God, quite frankly. I've seen what happens in Nevada, and I've seen some of the things that have taken place in other states, and I'm really glad that I'm not in those states. Oregon has a different approach to some things here, because in Nevada and other places, there's also an aspect of everyone trying to get around the rules. That bothers me. For several sides trying to find a way to get around the rules, Land Use Committee in the last session, and spent hours talking with people in my office about aggregate. I sympathize a great deal with what you've had to deal with in terms of the whole aggregate fight, because you had people who were next door neighbors, and the fact that a lot of the aggregate stuff seemed to come out of the fact that we were finding good aggregate or good sand and gravel and other things in exactly the best places for agriculture in some situations. So that kind of fight is something that I don't envy you having to sit through committee meetings and hearings on it. And they were not folks from Alabama. They were the next door neighbors. They were the farmers right around the area. So these are appeals that often are coming from, I think, legitimate sources, not just someone who wants to put a monkey wrench into things there. So I'm curious, and I'd be more interested, quite frankly, in finding out how we develop some kind of predictability within that.
If I could represent Steve Pfeiffer, for the record, your comments suggest that I agree with you on many levels, but I've been involved with Senate Bill 100 in one way or another, literally, like some of you perhaps, since its adoption. That is it served us well. Like any piece of legislation, it has issues, it has problems. We evolve with time, we improve on them. I would argue that some of the things we've talked about today that occurred in the Goal 5 rule may be an example of that, which is a long way of saying, if you think about reform in this context, think about it not to reform the entirety of the land use system in Oregon, because we have the most expansive land use system in the country, which makes that job that much more difficult. What we're suggesting, if anything, is that you focus on the aspects of the pro-regulatory schemes that are unique to aggregate for a couple of reasons. Number one, as you point out, Representative, we're looking for certainty, but one of the many things that's unique about aggregate or mining projects, because of that burden I noted earlier that the applicant bears because of the likelihood of an appeal and all, is the cost to an applicant to prepare an application and take it through in the way we've described it compared to other projects. It is not uncommon, if it's a credible application, and there are plenty of applicants of every flavor who don't have a credible application because they can't afford it or whatever it might be, we'll admit, you know, the fact that we're involved tells you that an applicant has decided they need to step up, spend the money, do it right, and make it indispensable and get as much certainty as they can. The cost of these things typically is $400,000 to often up to $600,000 or more just to get through the entire process we've described. I can think of one right off the top that never even got to the federal level, and it was still a $600,000 application because of the cost.
And it's not just I'll agree with you, and it's not just the cost in terms of money. It's also the cost in terms of time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And expectation and frankly, hope on the part of yeah. the folks, not just the ones who are directly involved, but also the community that's looking at this. So I understand what you're saying.
Yes, so what I'm going to suggest is that you focus on, again, providing some solutions, if you choose to go there, unique just to this kind of an application, and don't take on the entire program, because I think there are distinctions. One is that cost. That subdivision out there that may suffer the same level of delay on appeal and permitting could very well be 50, 60, 100,000. I can think of hospital master plans that were 100,000. In across the board in my entire 35 years of doing this, every time the application costs for an entitlement project for aggregate exceed by a factor of 3 or 4 any other permit that we obtain. The second point that makes us unique is that, and you alluded to this, Representative, we can't choose to cite where the conflicts, real or perceived, are less, where there's fewer residents that would be affected or any of that. We're forced to cite where the material is found.
Right.
And not only that, we have to have a volume of material of sufficient quality because part of our test is to meet the ODOT specs so that when you drive down the road that doesn't crumble beneath you. We have to find the quality and quantity of material at the right location to be able to justify even undertaking that level of risk and analysis and cost. That sometimes puts us in a place where there are inherently conflicts with surrounding agriculture, surrounding residences, whatever it is. The one I mentioned yesterday is one of the most widely acknowledged rock formations that formed from the Missoula floods back in the millennia. And there are 5 quarries within a mile and a half of this site. Now, that's not coincidence. That's because that's where the quality and quantity to a depth of 300 feet that aggregate lies. The point being, not only is it an expensive undertaking that we're looking for certainty on beyond the other land use cases, we're often in a situation where we have to walk into that uncertain environment at a location that in other instances we'd avoid. We'd put that hospital in a more less conflicted area. So for those and perhaps other reasons, aggregate's really unique for aggregate mining. Mining is location specific, and to be able to show because of the nature of the process that we've met all the criteria, it's extraordinarily expensive for an applicant. It's time-consuming and it's location-specific, all of which creates the perfect storm for complicated permitting.
Let me also add reclamation, which you didn't. No. That's one of the key issues as well when you're starting to talk about aggregate or
true.
Mining generally, but because the reclamation has been a frankly, historic problem, and so that it helps to make sure that that's part of the whole discussion there. So thank you. I appreciate that.
Actually, to keep on somewhat of a bright note, I can point to a recent success as it unfolds perhaps on that level. Reclamation is, as you can imagine, just intuitively.
Introduce yourself again.
Steve Pfeiffer, for the record. Reclamation is a matter of an applicant taking a long time to put that land back to the original or near the original contours. Where are they going to find that material? Because as we all know, when you dig a hole and you put it over here, you put it back, it's not going to fill the hole. And that's very true because we took the aggregate out in the meantime. It takes a long time to reclaim a site. Now, one simple, I'll just leave this with you. Dagami's conditions on operating permits for reclamation materials typically have a condition that say that you shall only use, quote, clean fill as determined by DEQ. DEQ has a definition of clean fill, or clean. Clean is that which is not a threat to the public health and safety. It's a very subjective call. That has led the industry, understandably, to not want to be very conservative on what fill material they take, which means they have to turn away a lot of material that comes from, you know, road projects or urban infill projects because it may have some historical contaminants, maybe low level, but any contaminant means an operator has to walk. DEQ would like to keep that low level, if any, contaminant out of the landfill as long as it's not a threat, but that's out of landfills. And they'd like to be able to have those mine land, the reclamation sites, be able to use that material. The industry's wary. There's a lot going on. In the last 2 years, DEQ and Dagami, on a positive note, have been working to modify that approach so that material that DEQ has reviewed and determines has no threat to the human health and safety can be used by those operators to backfill the permits. That will result in 2 pluses as this program unfolds, if it does, and it's really very fresh. It'll result in less material going to the landfill that really doesn't belong there, and it results in trying to get those sites being reclaimed more quickly than they otherwise would be. So there's an example of where the agencies actually took that one on themselves and have come to a good solution.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
You just mentioned 3 words that basically put some other things into perspective for me. First of all, when you talk about aggregates and, you know, putting them back, reclaiming them and putting them back, it's kind of like a landfill, you know. And when I was at Metro, we had a lot of issues with the St. John's landfill and, you know, there's issues with Riverbend and, you know, with where the landfills are actually sited. And they have, you know, many of the same issues that you folks have in some ways. And so the message that Representative Frederick there was getting at, I believe, was a message of balance. We have to have aggregate. You know, you have to have landfills or you have to have more recycling, but you have to deal with certain streams and needs. And we want roads. Economically, we want roads to be able to do, you know, we want railroads, we want regular freeways and highways and places for trucks to be, and so we have to have aggregate. So it's a source that we have to have unless somebody gets smart and figures out some other way to build those roads. But there has to be also a balance in the permitting process. So for me, you know, I'm hoping that one of the three of you, when we quit talking, are going to talk a little bit more about what are the challenges with Goal 5, what are the challenges with some of the other balance that you have to do to be able to get those, you know, permits to be successful and to be able to get the aggregate that the state of Oregon needs. Because we have to make the process work for you, and we have to make the process work for the supplying of the resource that we need. And so I see that as a necessary, as something that we need to figure out how to do better. But I don't believe that we'll ever get rid of the balance of having to deal with the overall systems of the environment or the overall systems of other issues that people feel are resources that they value and need. And one's clean water. Clean water and clean air, how basic can you get? And so it's figuring out how do we mine, how do we get that aggregate, how do we, you know, get the supplies of resources that we need for things like roads, for economic and other issues, but how do we stay true to the idea that we want to stay on this planet for as long as we can, you know, and we have some issues there to make that happen. So hopefully the three of you have got some more precise.
Well, Paul Rybernik, for the record, let me take a swing at that one, Representative McLean, see if I can. The process is multi-layered as we experience it now. The first thing that you have to do if you're going to do one of these mine sites is they have to do a post-acknowledgement plan amendment. That's to either get it on the inventory or somehow move it in an inventory thing so it can be permitted under the land use process that we have. The 1996 process that Steve was on, the committee, I was involved in that as well, we established the Goal 5 rule, which sets out parameters that direct local governments to make decisions about that. When we did that, we thought that there would be kind of one level of review that would be involved in that PAPA process, and it turns out that there's probably at least three levels of review in that process. There is a conflict minimization process, which I believe that the parties, when they sat down, they thought this was how we would get to it. If you can show that you meet the DEQ standards for air quality, for water quality, you've minimized the potential conflict that might be raised by someone immediately adjacent to this property. Same with vibration, same with noise, same with all kinds of other inputs. In reality, with regard to certain uses, there is a separate nuisance analysis you have to go through, that notwithstanding that you have your DEQ permits on your crusher that say these are the allowed air impacts that you, and you must meet all of these standards, you must have spray bars on your transfer points and places that would cause dust, that you must have a source of water, that you must protect water with your stormwater permits and all those kinds of things. You just have to do a separate nuisance for surrounding property. And there's even a third level of analysis that we have with regard to agriculture impacts, and that's that we don't force a significant change in accepted farming practices or significant costs. And so there's a three-level analysis to reach the same no impact standard in the very first step of the process. And that's not even coming back to the local government after you get through the PAPA process, assuming that you get through that after 2 years of appeals up and down, and it's actually can be a lot longer than that. Then you have to go back to the local government again and ask for an operating permit. Now, the local governments can bring all of those two things together, but they don't. And so there's at least four separate steps in the local process that are unique to this particular industry. And only then can you come, I think a rational applicant would come and say, okay, now we're going to go to our Department of Geology and Mineral Industry permit. Now we're going to talk to Water Resources Division about our dewatering or water quantity issues. Now we'll go back into DEQ and make sure that we've got everything else in place. We'll look at our ESA issues. We'll look at the Corps of Engineers. The Corps of Engineers then routes us back around to DEQ for a 401 certification. Before you even get to any of that other external regulatory thing in the land use process, there are multiple layers of things that we have to do. And there might be a way of consolidating that for this particular type of application. It might be some way to approach the process.
Okay. That's helpful.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I hope that our numerous questions did not in any way diminish what you had to say in terms of your testimony. So I apologize for the interruptions, but please proceed.
Yeah. Thank you, Martha Pagel. Let me step in to talk a little bit of the state regulatory overlays, and it gets to the question that Representative McLean raised about, you know, how do you address all of these really important regulatory issues. We have in Oregon a long history of having different state agencies look at different issues. As Paul just mentioned, you have DEQ on the quality side, you have water resources on the quantity side, you have all the different agencies, Dogami, the operating plan, different roles, different agencies, different permits, that all then stack up on top of the land use process that you've been talking about. I'm kind of jumping ahead to the bottom line of some of the thoughts that I wanted to share with you when you talk about regulatory reform. But I think one of the most important things that we're going to have to deal with as a state, not just for mining, but for any major project development, is to take a look at how we make all those independent decisions. And I've been in state government and in these circles long enough to know, I think I've been through at least four different agency consolidation efforts over the years that never went anywhere for a lot of reasons. Again, we have this history of the public constituencies and interests, and they don't want to be consolidated all into one. But somehow we need to get a better handle on the process. And we've made steps toward what we call consolidated permitting, especially in the mining industry for non-aggregate projects. There is a consolidated permitting process that's a pretty good start, and that's what we're doing on the Calico Gold Mining project outside of Vail. So you have all the agencies working together. You identify all the different permits that are going to be required up front. You coordinate also with the state or the federal agencies on the federal permitting. So it's a good idea. But no one's been through the process yet. The Calico project is as far as anyone has ever gotten in Oregon under this consolidated review, and Calico hasn't even filed an application. They've been in the pre-application phase for 2+ years already. What we don't know is how you get out the other end, and it's what I mentioned earlier, that there you will come a time when you're having all of these independent agency permits that are issued, and there's no way to bring them all together into a single Court of Appeals review or a single contested case hearing or Court of Appeals review. That's what we call supersiting in Oregon, and we do have that model for certain types of projects. We have the Energy Facility Siting Council. We have some prison supersiting. And I'm just throwing it out there. You know, if we were talking about regulatory reform, do we need some kind of a supersiting concept that at least brings the different permits together onto an integrated hearing and timing and appeals schedule so that you don't wind up in 14-year proceedings and you don't wind up 2 years before you even get to an application stage and then looking ahead? So a thought to throw out there. I also have some thoughts, if we have time to get to it, on just kind of individual agencies, how you can approach regulatory reform, some of the ideas to keep in mind.
Paul Rubinick, again, for the record, I threw out another example that pops to mind. In 2004, I have a client who applied a joint permit, but was a brand new thing between DSL and the Corps of Engineers, to do something related to gravel. We got a letter back from DSL about 2 years later saying when the Corps of Engineers does this recruitment study on the Willamette River, then we can look at your permit. And so we had it there. It's not critical to the operation at this point. It provided 30,000 yards of very clean gravel, very high-quality concrete aggregates. It's one of the 43 limited sites in the state of Oregon where we get these concrete aggregates. I get a call from a client in February, and he said, the Corps of Engineers is calling me, and they want to know why there hasn't been any action on this permit. So I call them up and say, because you haven't taken any action on the permit. And they say, okay, well, this is just unacceptable. This is 10 years. It's been sitting on somebody's desk. So they go in, and they immediately start processing the permit. They send Division of State Lands, or Department of State Lands now, they send them a letter, and we get a 14-page letter from DSL on the same issues that we talked about with them on in 2005 that we have to the person obviously didn't even read the application. They just went into the word processor and sent us all these things. So we call the Corps of Engineers up and we say, okay, how would you like us to respond to this? Because do you want to take the lead with DSL in this joint permitting process? Say, no, that's for you. So we go back to the DSL and we answer all of those things, all those questions. We make sure that the Corps has a copy. And that was done probably March. It's now May. There's simply no timeline for any kind of resolution of any of these issues, and it's a joint permitting process. So just the fact that you have a joint permitting process isn't enough. You have to have a way of making that joint permitting process function effectively. And the fact that both agencies, DSL and COE, are on the permit form and it looks really nice and you send it to both of them at the same time doesn't necessarily accomplish anything.
Chair Whitley's.
I've been thinking, Representative McLean, about your comment about Steve Fivergen, for the record, about the balance. And there's a bit of a deja vu moment there because it takes me back to those days when Paul and I and others were working on the rule. The concept that's most analogous to where you are as a body, if the legislature or the commission or anybody else in a policymaking mode, is mining inherently poses potential conflicts with surrounding uses, even on-site uses, be it natural resources, be it surrounding adjacent landowners and farm activities or whatever it is. And that's why the controversy and that's why the appeals and all the above. What we struggled with back in the day when we wrote that rule, and Paul alluded to this, is where do we draw the line on where the balance is struck between conflicts or potential impacts that others should be asked to absorb in return for being able to extract the resource that, as you note, we need as a society to prosper. It's not a matter of a subdivision with a subdivider's profit on the table. I mean, yeah, there's providing housing, but there's a lot of ways to provide housing. But again, we're in an industry where the resources are limited, they're site-specific, and frankly, we would argue are needed for our economy, et cetera, and roads. What we decided was the test that under the Goal 5 rule that we do bear when we identify a conflict or a potential conflict on surrounding properties or uses within that 1,500 feet, let's just pick noise. The extent to which there's a noise conflict as a result of the activity of the mining operation, the trucks, the loading, the occasionally the blasting, the crushing, and all that. And what the rule says is that where such a conflict or potential conflict is identified, it shall be minimized. Now, that's what the rule says. That's what we bear. That's what we have to convince the appellate bodies we have successfully done, as well as the Board of County Commissioners when they decide we approve. We've minimized that conflict. It could be well drawdown potential. It could be noise. It could be a lot of things. Could be degradation of air quality. Two thoughts. Number one, the phrase minimize the conflict is a bit circular. You know, that just begs the obvious question. What's minimize? What level is it minimized to the point where the other party should be required to accept that conflict, however, whatever it is? And we chose to define minimize as to a point where that conflict is no longer significant. Now, if there's a weak spot in that process, it might very well be that. I mean, we don't really have, at this point in time, a very clear, bright line between where a conflict, just at a high level societal, as you folks do on a regular basis, Where is it that if you accept the premise that a mining operation should in some level be approved and approvable, where is it that, and it's location specific, so unlike in wetlands where we're required to avoid where possible, we can't avoid that resource. And the fact that there are surrounding uses that occurred before we got there, even though there may be mines next door, where do you draw that line? And that's a challenge back to you more than anything. I mean, we would be happy to work with you on that because in retrospect, I've always thought if we stumbled somewhere in that legislative rulemaking, it's probably on that. And the courts haven't really helped us with it for reasons I can appreciate. A potential conflict shall be minimized, conflict to surrounding adjacent landowners and their activities, and it shall be minimized to the point where it's no longer significant, but it's just a circular analysis. And I don't know what the answer might be, but that's one point. The other thing that we tried to do, and I think we could do a better job of in the rule, is you've heard from all of us about the various levels of regulation. Some of them, we would argue, are duplicative, if not redundant. State, federal, local. We've got noise ordinances at the state level. We don't have them at the federal. We often don't have them at the county. We built into the rule what we call a safe harbor. And it says where that potential conflict that's been identified in your application is governed by or regulated under another state or federal regulatory scheme. Noise is a perfect example because DEQ does have a noise ordinance or noise stuff where we are. You are deemed to comply with the rule. So counties are required where an applicant can demonstrate that the subject of the conflict they may have, be it noise, be it air emissions or dust, if it's regulated by another regulatory scheme at the state or federal level and we can show we meet that, which we obviously have to do anyway, so it's efficient for us, the rule says that's it. It's over and you're deemed to be in compliance. That safe harbor goes a long way toward improving efficiency, and I think the safe harbor could be improved by being made more clear. It's not as clear as it could be. It too begs a lot of questions. Those are two things that we struggle with regularly, and I think they're both areas where, be it legislation or rulemaking, could really improve the scenario.
And just to follow up with that safe harbor thing, that was one of the beauties, one of the great constructs of the 1996 regulation was to have this objectively achievable way to minimize things if there are federal or state or local standards. Just to give you some practical kind of how this works. I wrote the noise chapter in the land use book. I think I'm probably one of the few people that understands what's going on with that. And there are specific set levels for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Just because you can demonstrate with a registered professional acoustical engineer that those levels are met does not necessarily mean that you get through the process with your hide on. And so there are lots of ways, even in this situation where we have objective standards in the land use process, that need improving. It's better than not having that, but you need to be very, very careful about saying that is objective. Someone will come in and say you didn't take the measurement point wasn't at exactly the right place. It needs to be 25 feet towards the noise generating source from the receiving window. Okay, well. Where in your report, Mr. Expert, does it say it could have been 24.6 inches? It could have 24 feet 6 inches. It could have been 27 feet. You have this big go around, and I'll tell you what will happen in that. You will go to LUBA, and LUBA will come back, and they will say to you, it's just not clear in that expert's report exactly where that was done. And the expert will say, I took it at the regular spot, the required regulatory spot. LUBA will reverse on that, and so you'll go back to the local government for a whole nother round, even though you have a $5,000 to $10,000 noise study that is absolutely perfect, and all someone had to say was, "No, I don't know. I don't think that was taken at the right spot," and you may very well lose on that. So it's a great construct. It's a revelatory construct. It's made things more predictable, to use Representative Frederick's theme, but it's not perfect and it needs work.
If I could also add, Martha Pagel, on the safe harbor concept, it gets back to those overlaying jurisdictional issues and to me, what is kind of the chicken egg syndrome, because if in the land use process you can show that you comply with your state permitting requirements in order to meet your safe harbor, but you can't get your state permit until you get your land use approval because of the land use compatibility requirements that we have for state agencies and exercising their regulatory authority, for example, water resources and water rights that I deal with a lot on these projects. We can't get the water right issued until the land use approval, so you can check the box to say you're compatible with the local land use. And then in the land use process, they say, well, you haven't got your water right yet, and how do we know that you really are going to comply with those requirements, even though you expect that you're going to get that? So coming back to the theme of regulatory reform, we need a better way to integrate and time and know what comes first and how you work your way through this process to get to an end point.
I thought maybe this might be a good time to talk about some of the things that I, Frank Erisman, am here to talk about. And an interesting thing today in the U.S. Senate, there's a hearing on a bill entitled the American Mineral Security Act of 2015. What you're beginning to see nationally is efforts to help the mining industry by identifying minerals that are critical. Rare earths 2 years ago were perceived to be critical because everybody's phone needed this or that. Well, the price of rare earths has come down. The clamor for permitting of mines in the United States is not so great. But this particular act requires that the director of the U.S. Geologic Survey will identify minerals that are critical, do surveys around the country, identify potential sources of these minerals, identify new sources of these minerals. To the extent that Oregon may want to send the message, at least in eastern Oregon, that they're open for mining other than industrial minerals, an effort like this federal act is something that I think that should be considered, and maybe a way that you can, on your goal 5, you can help the mining industry is identify and set aside these. There is under goal 5 procedures to identify natural resources sites. I was in Baker County in January. And using Baker County as an example, they have identified mainly old mining properties, but their land use sets that land aside for mining. And in addition, the land use says that properties that are adjacent to that should be made aware of the fact that they're next to a piece of property that is available for mining. I think what's happened in Oregon is because of the tough permitting overlay, what you've done is you've taken common minerals, industrial minerals, and made them valuable. Because what's really important as Oregon is to have a permit. And when you have a permit, you're golden. So it's a valuable asset. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I'd love to come to Oregon. I'd like the pluses that have developed in this state because of the tough zoning. But that overlay of zoning creates perception, among other things that have happened here, that it's a difficult state to mine in. I think that there are already in the statutes, in the Goal 5 procedures, ways that you could help mining by taking steps to identify and giving money, say, to the eastern counties, giving money so that they might be able to spend money to identify resources that are out there. The conflict will come. For instance, this American Mineral Security Act of 2015, they will probably say nickel is a mineral that we really need. And we have here in the state of Oregon, on federal lands and some private lands, some very important nickel deposits, which, you know, are in play and not too well liked by a lot of people. But it is something that I think that over the next 5, 10 years, there's going to be a lot of pressure to, because the mining industry is trying to find an answer, how can we help ourselves with respect to the permitting problems for federal lands? And what this act would do was create procedures to expedite permitting. It doesn't say we will do this or that. It says come up with a procedure to do that. And consolidation permits is one way they're going to try to do it. So I think there is, in the statute, some ways that if you wanted to protect a certain mineral deposit somewhere so that it can be developed in the future, you can do that.
Thank you very much. Panel members, again, my apologies. Did each of you have an adequate opportunity to make your presentation?
Paul Rubin, for the record, I think it's much more helpful for us to answer your questions. I think we don't really have a set piece that we need to give you here. We're here for your benefit.
All right, fine. Thank you very, very much. Committee members, additional questions. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did want to make a comment. You know, do most of the land use attorneys end up in Oregon? but something about the supersiting that I think you mentioned, Martha. So who qualifies for the supersites, and what is the criteria that they get to maybe be exempt from some of these other things in order to achieve that?
This is Paul Rubernick. I had a hand in 1990, I must have been like 13 years old at the time, in writing the prison, or the 89 session, writing the prison supersiting bill. And let me just tell you how that worked. And it's as only in the sense that here's a construct that you could consider. Basically, the legislature made a determination that we needed prison beds. There was a huge, huge, huge demand for prison beds. They then invited people to come in and say, give us some sites. And there were, I think, 15 sites that were to be considered. And the legislature told the local governments to balance these things, actually told the Department of Corrections to balance these things, and they picked the 5 or 6 sites. They then had set hearings on those. Those set hearings then determined the winners out of that, well, on a basis of lots of policy things, economics, location, need, all kinds of things. The appeal was directly to the Supreme Court, and there were 5 prisons under construction in about, 18 months from the time the legislation was enacted. It's probably a little stringent for mining, but that's a concept.
This is another way to approach that might be the Energy Facility Site and Council model, where an application comes in for a new project that meets certain threshold requirements, certain size of a project, and then all of the different state agencies that would have permitting authority over that identify their permits. You go through one process, one application, and it's kind of sent out then to the different agencies to review. They put their comments all together. They issue basically one permit that is integrated, has all of these pieces to it, and if there's an appeal, it's one appeal. And that's really the 30,000-foot level of that concept, but the idea is that obviously you're on a single hearing and review schedule.
This is Frank Garrisman. Other states in the West have done that. Wyoming, Montana, they have for mineral siting, for coal mines, for uranium processing facilities, they have a procedure that, and some of it's tied into what's the cost of the thing going to be. In other words, if it's going to be more than $50 million to put this in, then that kicks off the super siting process.
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, there is a beginning of that in the process that Martha mentioned in 19 for mining. But it's very limited in scope, in the sense that in 1993, a legislature enacted a statute on the chemical processing side so that mining involving chemical processing, which is a leaching process for minerals, basically, has, and again, Martha's in this now for the first time, and others are expected, some of us are expected to follow soon. For non-aggregate resources, which involve that kind of a process, we have, in my opinion, and it's echoing, I think, what Martha's saying, gone partway towards supersiting, but not completely. And there are two things I think you could do to extend that. For those who can be in the chemical processing statute, which Martha's now pioneering the way through, at the end of the day, it's almost like the FSEC. There's a team assembled of all the state agencies. There's local government participation. They get involved. They work as a very efficient one-size, one-shop process to review your application and impose conditions and whatever it might end up in. But one of the problems we see, unlike the FSEC process, which results in one siting certificate by the FSEC, the Energy Facility Siting Council, one certificate is issued, and the agencies who then, and the FSEC, the Siting Council, makes the decision within the footprint of that energy facility on whether all the state laws, as well as local land use regulations, are met. That authority is vested with the single body of FSEC, the Energy Facility Siting Council, and as Martha notes, it goes up on appeal. It's happened 10 times. It goes to the Supreme Court. It's very efficient. Where I think, in looking forward, we missed the bet a bit on the chemical processing statute is, unlike FSEC, or in this case, some other entity, and I'm not sure who it would be at this point, issues the permit for the chemical mining with one order that goes straight to the Court of Appeals. The way the statute reads now, and it hasn't been tested, each of those agencies then goes back to make their respective decisions in the normal course, which results in separate, multiple appealable decisions, even if they all go to the Supreme Court. One simple, elegant tweak would be to mirror the FSEC process, to have a body in place that upon that joint local government state agency review for the chemical mining process, a decision is made, one order is issued, and you only get appealed once. It's just so much more efficient. The second aspect of that, potentially for you to explore, is whether we should expand that process to non-chemical processing mineral extraction. Not necessarily aggregate, but all the other things that Frank and others and Paul have raised. In other words, right now you only get to take advantage of that, even if you could fix that shortcoming, if you happen to be in a leaching or that kind of a process, which gold is. I don't know much about nickel, but it may very well not qualify for that. I suspect it doesn't. So expanding the scope of that, expanding that to the maximum level to make sure that it covers as much of the mineral activity you'd like to see happen in this state, and then make it more efficient so it's a one order at the end as well as a single level of review would be really efficient. And send a positive signal to outside third-party private entities who may want to come into Oregon to take the opportunity.
Martha Pagel again, just a footnote that what was originally designed as the chemical process mining with basically cyanide heap leach open pit mining in mind, that was amended a few years back to have a broader application to other than that type of chemical processing, certain types of other types of mining projects. But the sort of missing link, as Steve pointed out, is still that you wind up at the end with all these individual permits on individual tracks.
I have a couple of questions here. Stephen, you mentioned the challenge of minimizing a conflict and the circular logic that involves. I suspect that as you continue to chase zero, there are those that could monkey wrench the system and make certain that there is sufficient conflict throughout the process to keep you chasing zero.
Yes, Chair Witt. At the end of the day, if we identify a noise conflict and we quantify it and we can tell what the decibels are at the bedroom level window of the house 300 feet away, forget the safe harbor for a minute. The question becomes, and we demonstrate that it's a 5 decibel increase during daytime hours at the house during the 500 feet away. The question always becomes, is that a successful minimization of the conflict to the level where it's no longer significant? We may think it is. You may think differently. And LUBA, yet again, may think entirely differently because there's no guidance to the appellate body. One of the problems with appeals, if there's a problem at all, and this is where my sympathies lie with the LUBAs and the Court of Appeals of the world, their efficiency and predictability is dependent upon the level of objectivity or lack of discretion in that local standard. In other words, if we give the appellate bodies a very broad subjective test, somebody's always going to say they got it wrong, because there's just that, it makes it that much more. They have to step in and make their own decisions, make cold calls on the record, interpret the law, and a few other things. The more you can refine those local criteria that the Board of County Commissioners decides yes or no they're met, and LUBA's required to review that, the more predictability we're going to get. And that's where the safe harbor really adds value, because that does tend to be a more objective test. But yeah, I only bring that up as almost an academic point to illustrate, if you accept the premise, as I think we all must, that all land use and certainly mining activity will create impacts on surrounding activities and uses. Now the question becomes, what level of such impact, assuming you can quantify and identify it, is adequate and acceptable to allow that use to nonetheless be approved? And that's a gray area. I don't quite know how you refine it more clearly. We've tried in local land use on numerous occasions. Some codes strive for objective measures. We all know that a building can only be built 75 feet. We know that it can't occupy more than 35% of a site. Those objective criteria are wonderful, and as a matter of predictability, we're perfectly fine with those. Where it gets this subjective, you lose that predictability, and that means we're, as I pointed out to the commission back in the day, we shouldn't be letting, in my opinion, the appellate courts dictate land use policy in this state by leaving them with such subjective criteria that they have no choice but to make the law on their end rather than have them decide whether somebody else met the law that was decided at the local or state level. That was the genesis of the rule, to get put more certainty into the process, more clarity into the criteria, so that the appellate courts wouldn't be setting our land use policy. It would instead be folks like you and the commissioners themselves and the Board of County Commissioners. Where that line is, it's hard to say.
Panel members, you've described a series of challenges that folks that perhaps would be interested in developing mines here in the state of Oregon face. Ms. Pagel, your anecdote about Calico, more than two years into the process and no application yet, really caught my attention. We heard in an earlier hearing that Oregon has the potential of being or has one of the greatest potentials of the Western states in terms of undeveloped minerals resources. Many of you here, perhaps all of you, represent private clients. Can you characterize for us the reaction of clients and their willingness to come in and add to Oregon's economy, given the level of challenges that you have described here for us today?
Yeah, this is Frank Erisman. Let me take that by referring you first to the Fraser Institute at University of British Columbia. I think it's every year the Fraser Institute takes a poll of mining companies. I think the last poll was about 75 mining companies, and they rate jurisdictions around the world. It's country, it's by state, at FraserInstitute.org, you can see this information, and then they discuss the factors that mining companies would look at if they want to come to a particular jurisdiction. Not surprisingly, in 2011, the number one jurisdiction was Nevada, followed by Saskatchewan. Wyoming was 10th. Oregon was not rated. Washington was. Washington, out of 79, was 57th, and that's mainly because, and this is hard minerals, it's not sand and gravel, aggregates, industrial minerals, and that was because there's a gold operation up near Republic, Washington, that Kinross has. Mm-hmm. I have had, Martha talks about the Calico thing. Back in the early 90s, Newmont Gold, which is a large international gold company, got an option on that property. I represented Newmont on that. It was acquired from a company called Atlas. Newmont was not afraid to come to Oregon. they were coming to Oregon because they thought this might be an extension of what they were doing down in Nevada. They thought they understood the geology. For them, they initially then had to fight the proposal for a moratorium on the use of cyanide in Oregon, which led to the chemical processing law. But it wasn't big enough for them, so they didn't stay. I worked with Texas Gulf in far eastern Oregon in the 70s. They were looking for copper and polymetallic minerals. They were interested. But truth be told, when I talk to most people, they don't have a lot of interest in Oregon. And it's a combination of things that you might not expect. The moratorium on dredging, for instance, you know, it wouldn't affect a big gold operation. But it's just one more thing that says, oh, there goes Oregon again. The fight over hauling coal through Oregon. Well, that's just one other thing that you run into. So it's a combination of things. And geology is a large part of it, too. There's better geology in other places, but there is also some potential for good geology in eastern Oregon that probably has not been looked at enough. Typically, mining companies like to go back to where there had been something before,
mm-hmm.
and there's been some pretty significant gold mining out there. You have in Oregon some very significant industrial minerals like perlite and pumice and diatomaceous earth and that sort of things, and that's being mined, but more can be done there. So I think the perception's not good. How do you overcome that? I talked in Baker, and I mentioned when I was in Baker City that some states have incentives. You open up the first mine in such and such county, and we forgive the taxes for a little bit, you know, for a year or two or something like that. I mean, there's ways you can do it, mm-hmm. but I recommend if you want to get active in trying to encourage mining, that you take a look at the Fraser Institute's papers and what they've done up there, because it discusses the whole realm of what people would look at, like labor and tax, all sorts of things. But first of all, it has to be something to go after.
Thank you for that recommendation. Anyone else?
Chair Witt, I would simply say that my observations are that the larger the deposit, it takes a large deposit for a company to entertain the permitting process in Oregon, for the reasons we've talked about. Again, not a judgment, it's just what it is. And the other problem that I see is we don't have a solid base of information about the nature of our deposits, particularly for minerals and industrial minerals. And part of the reason we don't have that is because of the perception among the international and other companies who would do that inventory work that Oregon isn't, for lack of a better phrase, open for business. So you have this circular situation where we don't have the inventory base because the companies that would do that work don't feel likely to come here, so they don't know that there may be very significant deposits that would justify going forward even with our regulatory scheme. I think, therefore, one of the things, and that was what one of those earlier bills would do, is to figure out a way to either incentivize private companies to do that inventory work or somehow have the state undertake that, which is what one of those pieces of legislation would do. That, to me, is the first step. Let's find out what's out there and be able to illustrate to the outside third parties who are very experienced in other parts of the world and other parts of this country that there's a reason to come to Oregon. Because right now, we're in this situation where nobody really has a reason to even think about it or overcome the rumors. And we all work to overcome the rumor that we're not open for business. We tell people you can get permits. We can prove that you can get permits. We can send people the permits we get. Painful as they may be, we got them. But until we have somebody's interest, we don't even get to make the pitch. So if we could figure out how to get that inventory in place, it'd be a huge first step.
I'm also wondering if segments of the bar would be interested in making perhaps a recommendation to us after evaluating the problems that are experienced and perhaps making a recommendation, as Ms. Pagel did, that we model after the Energy Facilities Siting Council. That this may be a course of action that the legislature would like to consider. I think that that would be very helpful. And I don't know if there's a committee in the bar that would handle something like this.
Senator Witt, we're kind of ticking through several options, but the idea is really interesting to me. We have an environmental law section of the bar that really focuses on the permitting and regulatory side of things. We have a land use, real estate and land use group. We have an administrative law section of the bar. I think there are lawyers who do a lot of this kind of work who would be really interested in having that kind of open discussion and coming forward with some ideas. It takes a lot of work, and all of us, you know, we have jobs to do, but we
certainly
also spend a lot of time working on the bigger picture in Oregon in various levels, and so I think working through these sections of the state bar is an excellent idea, at least to do some outreach and see if they'd be interested in working together on a task force or some recommendations or some kind of report back.
Thank you for your interest. Committee members, anything additional? Vice Chair McLean?
Well, just to that last comment, I really think that, you know, if it's between the super siting and the siting of energy, the one that you described, that process, that's much more interesting. That super siting was miserable, and I had to sit through a couple of those prison super sitings, not fun. And really, anytime you say the word super siting, that causes, you know, all kinds of issues. So I wouldn't be interested in that at all. But in looking at the other one, that sounded like there was at least the idea of one review, one order. I mean, those two things make some sense. You're trying to make a stepped process. When you're dealing with all these agencies and everybody has their own piece and nobody knows who's on first, who's on second, who's on third, it doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help the agencies be efficient. It doesn't help the applicant to be efficient. But if there was actually a stepped process or a singular review and a singular order, then at least there's something to start with and end with. But the rest of it sounded just like chaos. So.
Well, and Representative, you remember, it wasn't the most transparent process
right.
that we've ever had.
Right.
I would substitute supersiding for consolidated review.
Yeah.
That's really what
yeah.
FSEC and the Chemical
yes.
Processing Statute tries to achieve.
Very good. Anything further? Panel members, thank you so very, very much. Certainly have given us a lot to consider, and anyone who's interested in following up, I'd make myself available.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to respond to what we've heard this morning? Please.
Who has standing to sue and make these complaints? Is
yeah.
the biggest part.
No, it's true.
Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here today with the Oregon Farm Bureau, and I know you guys are probably anxious to get out of here, so I'll be very brief. But just wanted to offer a little bit of an alternative perspective and some of the reasons that some of these issues, I think, have been somewhat difficult to address legislatively. As several of you have pointed out, many of these aggregate projects in particular are sited on farm and ranch land throughout Oregon. And as you guys are aware, Oregon is one of the largest, agriculture is one of the largest industries in Oregon, and one that our organization works tirelessly to protect on a daily basis. And as the panelists acknowledged, there is an inherent level of conflict that occurs with these types of projects being located on agricultural land and some of the difficulties we've had when trying to sit down and figure out, okay, how do we address this and what is the appropriate level of impact, is that some of the methods of streamlining the process really have excluded or would exclude farmers from raising legitimate impacts on their operations. And since aggregate is an overlay over the farm use zoning, it's a difficult conversation to have when you're looking at a farmer having to significantly alter, change, or have an increased in cost associated with another industry. industry coming in and being sited next to them. So these have been difficult conversations, but ones we have engaged in. But to comment way back to the earliest part of this presentation, when we started to look at land use issues in particular in aggregate and farm zones, we found that aggregate sites have a 97% success rate of being sited on farmland. So overwhelmingly, the projects do get sited. And farmers, as it stands now, the existing process does allow them to have a voice. And like we pointed out, it's not usually the folks from Alabama coming in saying, "Oh, we have this issue. We don't want to see this in Oregon." It's neighboring landowners, but sometimes, you know, a little ways down the road that say, "Well, actually, when you do this way, it's going to cause me to have to, you know, I can't get trucks in anymore. I can't get my goods to market. We need to address that." And so we just want to make sure that as we're talking about potential changes to the process, that you all have an understanding that particularly in the Valley, we see most of these issues in the Valley. These are really close to longstanding farming and ranching operations that run their business in a certain way and need to run their business in a certain way. We're an industry with already extremely thin profit margins. We're price takers in the market. So we're not an industry that can readily absorb increased costs if you have to, you know, route your trucks 2 miles in a different direction or figure out some way to, you know, do 3 more rounds of washing your vegetables before you can get them off because of dust impacts. So it is difficult conversations to have, and we are certainly not opposed to aggregate, but feel that the existing process is protective of farmers and ranchers in the process, and a lot of the changes that are suggested would essentially exclude folks from the process. And 2 more points to touch on. You heard a little bit about safe harbors and a little bit about supersiting, so I want to talk about both of those points. The safe harbor issue for us is a little bit of a red herring, because when the state issues its permits, it's looking at public resources and impacts to the public. What the land use process looks at is, okay, is this going to significantly increase the cost of a farmer's operation, significantly force a change in their operation? And sometimes the permitting may be acceptable, for example, of a level of dust impact that isn't going to cause, you know, a public harm to folks existing in the area, but it still may impact, for example, the ability of the neighboring farmer to get his vegetables to market in a cost-efficient manner. And so they're really looking at 2 different issues. The public health issue is very different than the issue of impacts to neighboring farmers, which is why the safe harbor conversation has been a difficult one. I can't really speak to other state permits and the extent to which streamlining those may create some efficiencies. For us, we really focus on the land use process, and just want to emphasize that in that process, the existing controls are there for a reason, and it's because it's an overlay on those ag zones, and it's designed to ensure that those farmers don't have to, you know, bear a significant increase in their costs of production because their neighbor chose to sell their property to an aggregate company. And in the supersiting, my understanding is that prisons and energy facilities are the only 2 types of land use that we really supersite in Oregon. The energy facility is because it's a linear facility that goes through multiple jurisdictions. So my understanding is they thought it would be difficult to, you know, go to each county and go through their individual land use process to get a, you know, for example, a transmission line sited. In regards to aggregate, the local county process has been effective, 97% success rate, and we don't see a need for supersiting those projects, at least as it absorbs the land use component. And as I explained, the land use piece really is markedly different in what it looks at and what it's designed to address than the other state permits. So there may be some consolidation of the state permitting that would make a lot of sense. But the land use process is really designed to look at, okay, how does this fit into this community? Is it going to impact the neighbors? What is the appropriate level of impact on the neighbors? And that really is a local decision. It's why our land use system is designed how it is, so that the local governing bodies can say, okay, how do we want this to fit into our community? What do we think the appropriate balance to strike is? And we think that the existing process is quite effective as it deals with those concerns. So I'm also happy to take any questions that anybody has.
Well, Ms. Nash, it is a difficult discussion. And the important and the operative word is discussion.
Yes.
And you personally and your organization in general has been willing to carry on that discussion. Your representation is always professional. I have seen you in other committees before, and it causes me to sit there and wonder, now what's the Farm Bureau's angle on this? So I know that you have every single issue covered constantly, and the fact that you are willing to engage in those discussions is all important. And in terms of the Natural Resources community, we must make absolutely sure that we do not allow ourselves to be divided and conquered, and you certainly make that possible. So I want to commend you for that. Vice Chair McLean.
I just want to add one little piece to that. First of all, as I pointed out, the supersiting process is not one that I don't appreciate it. It's just that I think there are issues with it too, mm-hmm. not just perception. But I do believe that consolidation of a one-stop, one review, one order is something that doesn't mean that there aren't people at the table or that it right. happens extraordinarily fast, but it happens in an efficient way. And so the efficiency issue is what I want. I want people not to feel as if the system's broken, so they try mm-hmm. legislative fixes. I wasn't real fond of the grand bargain mm-hmm. because of that on land use in Washington County out my way. And again, we don't want the system to be so broken that people get panicked and then they try these other things. But reviewing a process, efficiency, making sure everybody's still at the table, making sure that everybody still has their issues and their concerns taken care of, I think that is something to look at. And so I agree with, you know, the comments that you made that, you know, the farmers and the agricultural and the competing businesses and everybody else that's going to be in the same world, we have to figure out how to make it an efficient system and a balanced result. And everybody's, you know, issues have got to at least be there at the table. So please in no way believe that because I said I was interested in a one-stop, one process or, you know, basically a one order or something that's going to make the process work better. 14 years sounds like a long time in a process
yes.
to me. And I don't think, you know, I mean, that's a long time.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important for us to be open to trying to improve all of our systems at all times.
Marion, thank you very much for always keeping your issues and interests before us. Please. Anyone else from the public? Last and final call for a public comment.
Peggy Lynch, Legal Women Voters of Oregon. Thank you very much, and I apologize for having to step out because I was listening to the ODF&W presentation over at Natural Resources Budget, which is why I'm here today, a couple of reasons. So not to go on with what Marianne had to say, but two other kinds of things. Permitting. One of the things that we have done over the last few years is created regional solutions teams, which provide a venue for multiple agencies to sit together to work on these projects. And I don't know if it was mentioned in the previous presentation, but that is one of the streamlining discussions to try to at least get all of the different agencies who might be having to work on a project in one room so that they can help the applicant know what the timing is of each, what the process is for each, to try to help with this, make the system better and make make the permitting be fair to all sides, but at least so that the applicant really has a handle on the broader picture. The other thing I wanted to mention relates, in wearing my budget hat, relating to Dogami and the discussion about whether or not the state should have Dogami spend some money to help with this situation. We're making choices this session related to budgets, and the League, frankly, has chosen to advocate that if there is any money for Dogami, and Dogami gets almost no general fund, it should be to help with natural hazards planning, that we try to make sure that in this, as we are seeing the lumpy weather happening, and it's happening not just in on the coast, but but there are effects around the state, that we need to spend whatever limited general fund dollars that we might have for Dogami to do natural hazards. So those are the two pieces of things I just wanted to share with you. I will listen to the other hour of testimony. I have worked with at least two of these people in the past on issues related to streamlining and permitting.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McLean.
The one thing that they said when you were out of the room that I think was really important, because I don't know too much about these streamlined teams or these permitting teams, but is the idea that you get everybody in the same room. They all tell them what their processes are, but it's like who's on first, who's on second, who's on third, because nobody wants to go first. Well, I need my water permit, or do I need my land use permit, or how am I going to get over here with, you know, the resource water folks? But it has to be something where there's a pragmatic way that the agencies expect it to happen, because otherwise the person who comes in with the application is just up to, they get to decide where to start and hope it works out.
So, Chair Witt, Vice Chair McLean, that's disappointing for me to hear, because, in fact, the governor has a staff person that is supposed to assist with these teams, putting them together and helping make this happen. There are at least two and sometimes three Business Oregon staff people that are attached to these regional solutions teams. So if, in fact, the second part of what's supposed to happen with those teams is not happening, then we need to have that conversation, because we are certainly spending a great deal of general fund dollars and staff to try to see that this situation, that this process is improved. And I see it as an improvement not just for the applicant, but for citizens who care about what's happening on their land. They don't want to have to go through 60,000 different permitting processes either. And so we continue to have these kinds of conversations to try to do both things. And just a quick comment, Rick, OCAPA always says, gee, you know, how did you get here on roads with aggregate? I need to tell him, you know, and what did you eat for dinner on the food from your table from the farmland? So, anyway.
I just, Madam, yes. Mr. Chair, sure. I just wanted to say it's on my list. So it doesn't matter if you get everybody in the room. It's got to be a programmed process. And so I want it to be on your list, too.
Sure. I'd be happy to. I'm the person who follows regional solutions around here.
Very, very good.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you so very, very much. And with that, Mr. Gallagher, can you remind us what we have coming up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on Thursday, we've got a public hearing and possible work session on SB 248, which authorizes the state forester to enter into and administer contracts for activities necessary or convenient for sales of timber from lands, coming up with more creative ways to market that timber. We also have a public hearing on House Bill 2049, which authorizes certain hunters to use battery-powered scoping devices.
All right. With that, we will, unless there's anything else for the good of the order, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.